from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The High Technology Foundation, headquartered at the I-79 Technology Park in Fairmont. Online at WVHTF.org.
At the legislature today, when their party took over control of the House and Senate, Republicans promised tort reform. Several bills are moving through the legislative process, including one about nursing home administrators that was up for amendments on the Senate floor today. And we'll find out more about West Virginia's prevailing wage law. It's also a target of the new majority. We'll talk with a fiscal policy expert and one of our state House colleagues covering the issue on the legislature today. Good evening, I'm Ashton Mara. A bill about the qualifications for the position of state labor commissioner has been the focus of discussion in the House this week. It will be on the floor for consideration next week. Liz McCormick reports.
The Government Organization Committee met to discuss a number of bills, one of which was House Bill 2217, relating to the qualifications of the commissioner of labor. With a bill that's been getting a lot of attention, it was relatively quiet in committee today, with only one vocalized vote against it progressing to the floor. Earlier this week, this was not the case. On Tuesday, the Committee on Industry and Labor first saw the bill, and some delegates were very concerned. Currently in state code, the Commissioner of Labor is described as a competent person who is identified with the labor interests of the state. House Bill 2217 strikes that language to read, has knowledge and experience in employee issues and interests including employee-employer relations in the state. This language change didn't go over well with Delegate Mike Caputo from Marion County.
If you look at the amendment, you're getting much broader. Now the labor commissioner is going to look out for the coal mine owner or the widget factory owner because it says, including the interests of employee-employer relationships. So is my assumption correct that he or she would have to have some background in HR work now?
I don't know that that's necessarily true. The language that we've used here in the amendment says that they are to be identified with and have knowledge and experience in employee issues and interests. And then it goes on to say, of employee issues and interests, that would include employee-employer relations. So the language here, I think, is to still make sure that the commissioner is looking out for employee issues.
But Caputo wasn't convinced. He asked for the current commissioner of labor, John Junkins, to speak to the committee.
Your interpretation of your job, Mr. Commissioner, is that to protect the working men and women in St. Louis County?
Yes, it is.
Is it your interpretation of the job that you look out for them more than you look out for the business owners?
West Virginia Division of Labor is an agency of statute. We enforce the statutes that the legislature passes. Those statutes are that labor enforces are entirely for the protection of the employees that work in this state.
Entirely for the protection of the employees.
Yes, sir.
Delegate Darrell Cowles from Morgan County, however, felt like the word change made more sense.
Do you believe those employee interests involve or include employee-employer interest and how that relates to employees?
I'm of the opinion that on a regular basis, we make decisions that's based upon company policies.
So as those employee-employer relations relate to the employee and the employee interests and issues, that seems to be very important to know and understand in West Virginia if you're going to be the labor commissioner.
You have to be the one to interpret those, yes.
More delegates on both sides questioned the commissioner about the qualifications this bill might adjust and about employee-employer relations. But by the end, there was a distinct split on feelings about the word change.
We've heard from the commissioner, and this agency was established in 1898. and its purpose was to protect the worker. That's what the gentleman said, protect the worker. Now, take a look at the language in this amendment. I can see a CEO becoming labor commissioner for the state of West Virginia. Maybe that CEO worked at a factory for a year or two and got into management, worked his or her way through, became CEO. Now, all of a sudden, they're going to come down and protect the interests of the worker? That's insane. That's just absolutely insane. Look, we've got to have good labor-management relationships at the workplace. But this agency is not about that. This agency is to look out for the worker.
Delegate Cowles spoke again to support the change.
And the bill says, the amendment would say, a competent person identified with employee issues of the state and has knowledge and experience in employee issues and interest, including employee-employer relations. It would seem to me that employee-employer relations are very important, indeed very important, to the interest of employees. It simply clarifies the mission and direction, the mandate of the office does not change with this bill, doesn't gut anything. The mission and mandate do not change. The qualifications and experience of the appointed position are simply clarified.
House Bill 2217 will report to the floor for its first reading on Monday. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Liz McCormick in the House.
Many labor-related bills are just beginning to make their way through the legislative process, but they've already begun attracting attention, perhaps none more than a bill that would repeal the state's prevailing wage requirement. Here to discuss the implications of such a repeal and what lawmakers are saying about it are Sean O'Leary, he's a policy analyst with the West Virginia Center on Budget and Policy, and Joel Ebert, State House reporter for the Charleston Daily Mail. Thank you both for being here with us.
Thank you.
So, Sean, let's just start basic. What is prevailing wage? Can you describe that for us?
Sure. Prevailing wage is a policy that's been around since the 1930s. And what it does is it sets a minimum wage and benefits standard for construction workers who work on government-funded public construction projects, those who build schools, roads, bridges, those types of things. And what that does is that it helps make sure that when we have government-funded construction projects, that it's done by workers with a lot of experience, high-level skills, and are very productive. And it keeps the government bidding process from becoming just a race to the bottom to bring in the cheapest labor you can get. It helps also make sure that those jobs are kept in the community and the wages that are paid through the tax dollars are to local workers and helps strengthen the economy and create some good-paying jobs.
So, Joel, we've seen these bills be introduced in both houses. Recap for us where they stand right now.
There were two introduced in the Senate prior to this week. They actually haven't moved. They were sent to, I believe it was Industry and Labor. I've been told by Republican sources that they're still a few weeks away from actually addressing those two. In the Senate, they had three that were introduced since the beginning of the session. Two were very early. This week, we saw one that was drafted and put forth on Thursday, and on the same day that it was actually introduced, it was sent to a committee.
Okay, and that got pulled. One of those Senate bills got pulled from committee yesterday, so much like we saw earlier in the session with the first prevailing wage bill. Sean, you've written a report. The Center on Budget and Policy has written a report on what would happen should one of these bills pass. Can you detail that report for us? What did you all find?
Sure. One of the things we looked at is just what some of the research out there that says about construction cost and prevailing wage. And the big conclusion is that when you look at states without prevailing wage laws and those states that do have prevailing wage laws, there's really no difference in their public construction cost. The reason for that is the prevailing wage law attracts more experienced, more skilled workers. And when you pay those workers that higher wage, their productivity and higher skills, they do the job a little bit more efficiently. And that lowers the cost, even though the higher wage raises the cost, and the two sort of balance out.
So are we similar? Are there states around us who have prevailing wage laws? Do we have neighbors who do this?
Some neighbors do. Some neighbors don't. Ohio has a prevailing wage law, but it exempts school construction, for example. Virginia doesn't have a prevailing wage law. Pennsylvania does. Kentucky does. So there's a good mix. Overall, 32 states across the country do have prevailing wage laws, and they're pretty geographically diverse. But of our neighbors, Virginia and Ohio are the two that don't have prevailing wage laws.
So AFL-CIO President Kenny Perdue was on our show last week to talk about prevailing wage just as it started to get introduced. And he made the point that should West Virginia get rid of prevailing wage, outside contractors will bring in workers and that will bring down the wage amount, that will bring down everybody's wages. Did your report study that at all?
Yeah, that's what the research shows, is that prevailing wage helps keep jobs local because the wages are set at the local level. So what you pay in, when they determine the prevailing wage rates, they base it off of the wage rates at that local level. When you don't have a prevailing wage law, that encourages contractors to, you know, find the cheapest labor available, and oftentimes that means that they're bringing in out-of-state workers. But then when that happens, again, you have less efficiency, less productivity, and you don't end up seeing any actual overall cost savings.
So, Joel, this report came out earlier this week, and you wrote about it. You asked both Republicans and Democrats about what the Center on Budget and Policy found. What did they have to say?
Sort of what you would expect of both parties. The Republicans, first thing they pointed out was basically look at the funding for the organization that did it. They noted that it was actually the organization is funded by some labor groups, including the AFL-CIO. So they basically argued that this report pretty much backs that position of labor. So they've been saying that the Republicans believe there should be a free market approach to construction projects that are funded by the government. Senator Mitch Carmichael has been a vocal proponent of repealing, and as has Senator Blair, and they've basically said that the findings of the report do not surprise them because of the position of the actual organization. Democrats, on the other side, have basically said that the report validates their perspective, that it will actually harm the state if there is a repeal of the prevailing wage. Senator Kessler got up on Thursday and spoke about the impact that the legislation would have, and said that people in his community, including businesses, have said that it will drastically hurt its workers.
Kessler, on the floor of the Senate yesterday, he was pretty strong in stating his opinion. And we've been getting really strong speeches from him on the floor this year, so that's been interesting. But, Sean, I'd like to ask you to respond to some of that. I mean, is the center siding with labor unions? Are you all partial to what they have to say?
Well, I think the response that the report's gotten speaks volumes. None of the criticisms actually addressed any of the content of the report. And that's because the evidence of the report speaks for itself. Construction costs are not lower in non-prevailing wage states than they are in prevailing wage states. West Virginia's construction costs are actually lower than almost all of our neighboring states, including Virginia and Ohio, who don't have prevailing wage laws. And the states that have repealed their prevailing wage laws haven't seen any cost savings. So the fact that they don't like that result, or that they don't like that that's the position that labor takes, doesn't speak to what the actual results and the data and the evidence say.
Maybe more generally, does the center see itself as a partisan or a nonpartisan place?
We're a nonpartisan group, but we support policies that we think help families, help working families, support local jobs, and support the economy. And prevailing wage, the evidence shows, is one of those policies.
Okay. There's another report that you all are coming out with next week, and that's based on the governor's budget. Can you preview that report for us a little bit?
Sure. Each year we put out a review of the governor's proposed budget and how the governor is trying to balance the budget. And again, this year we're doing a lot of moving around of different funds, drawing from the rainy day fund, surplus revenues from previous years, trying to make ends meet. And what that means in the long run is that the harder it is to balance the budget, the harder it is for the state to make investments in the things that we do need to make investments in, like higher education, like children living in poverty, like our underpaid corrections officers and teachers. But as long as we're still struggling to deal with the pay for these tax cuts of the past few years and make ends meet with the budget, those things are just going to have to be put off.
So, Joel, I know you've been covering the budget kind of broadly, but this year we're seeing a bigger push. Senator Hall and Delegate Nelson, the finance chairs, were on earlier this week, and their goal is to not have an extended budget session. Do you think they can make it with the pace that they're taking right now?
Well, the way things are going right now, it seems that they want to pass the important things quite early. They do not want the marathon session of the last day. So, I mean, if that's what they want to do, I would anticipate that that's exactly what could happen. We'll have to find out and see what exactly will go on, though.
That would be an unusual last night, Sean.
That's right. Usually the last night of the session is a marathon session of passing all the bills that we've talked about all session long. So if they get those big bills out of the way early and spend some time on the budget, that would be a surprise.
Well, and I think, you know, part of the reason that they want to have everything done first is obviously because they anticipate there's going to be some veto effort by the governor. With having majorities in both chambers, you're going to have that time where they can override any veto. So obviously, that's why those issues, prevailing wage, right to work, are coming up early in the session and will probably be addressed before the end of February.
Joel Ebert with the Charleston Daily Mail and Sean O'Leary with the Center on Budget and Policy. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, more discussion about tort reform. But first, here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the Senate today.
Among the bills introduced in the Senate today, Senate Bill 370, the governor's bill to codify and reorganize existing committee and subcommittees relating to the governor's Committee on Crime, Delinquency, and Prevention. Senate Bill 371, to provide for the application of the doctrine of forum non conveniens when civil actions involve both legal resident and non-resident plaintiffs. This refers to forum shopping or picking a court merely to gain an advantage in the proceeding. Senate Bill 372, to encourage the resolution of civil cases pending in civil courts through mediation. Senate Bill 373, to allow an image displayed on a wireless communication device to serve as proof of insurance on a motor vehicle. Senate Bill 377, to adopt and codify the learned intermediary doctrine as a defense to a civil action against a manufacturer or seller of a prescription and over-the-counter drugs based upon inadequate warnings or instructions. This doctrine is primarily used by pharmaceutical and medical device manufacturers in defense of lawsuits. Senate Bill 379, to establish the West Virginia State Infrastructure Bank within the Division of Highways in cooperation with the Federal Infrastructure Bank Program to provide funds for transportation projects. And Senate Bill 381, to create a special revenue account for the commemoration of the West Virginia State Police 100th anniversary in 2019. Up for passage in the Senate on Monday, Senate Bill 6 provides a mechanism to increase the limitation on civil damages in medical malpractice cases to account for inflation by linking increases to the Consumer Price Index. It also requires appellate courts to review certain decisions made by circuit court judges, adds provisions limiting the admissibility and use of certain information, and requires adjustment of verdicts for past medical expenses. Senate Bill 7, to require CPR to be taught in the public school system as a condition of graduation. And Senate Bill 335, the governor's bill to allow initial responders to possess and administer opioid antagonists in suspected drug overdoses to ensure this remedy is made available to individuals at risk of overdose, as well as to relatives, friends, and caregivers. On second reading, Senate Bill 249, to voting by straight party ticket.
Senators approved a bill today giving the Department of Agriculture control of the state's deer, elk, moose, and caribou farming operations. The program was previously overseen by the Division of Natural Resources, and lawmakers have been working to make the change for years, they say, to promote new livestock industries. It was a bill on second reading, the amendment phase that incited some intense discussion between lawmakers on the floor. Senate Bill 6 is another Republican-led tort reform. It amends the state's Medical Professional Liability Act to include new protections for nursing home administrators.
Senate Bill 6 focuses on closing a loophole some attorneys have found in the state's legal system when it comes to suing nursing homes. When those facilities are sued for a medical issue, they are protected to some degree by the state's Medical Professional Liability Act. That act sets limits as to how much a plaintiff can be awarded in a medical malpractice case. The act, however, does not protect the administrators of those companies. So some attorneys have found if they sue the nursing home's parent company based on administrative issues like staffing numbers, they can get around award caps. Senator Chris Walters of Putnam County says he believes the loophole needs to be closed, but he asked his fellow senators to take the issue a step further, holding medical administrators more accountable. His amendment says if the administration didn't take appropriate steps during the hiring process, like not conducting background checks of potential employees, then those lawsuits should not be subject to the award caps.
This doesn't affect any doctors whatsoever, does not hurt the doctors who are practicing medicine whatsoever, but it says if the administration is acting in willful, wanton, and reckless disregard of patient safety, then the non-economic caps don't apply. And Mr. President, I reserve my right to close.
Senate Judiciary Chair Charles Trump asked members to remember the state of West Virginia's health care system before the Medical Professional Liability Act was passed more than a decade ago.
We had a situation in this state where doctors were lined up at the borders of our state. Trauma centers were threatening to close. Insurers were refusing to write medical malpractice coverage in West Virginia. We had at the time, and I was in the House of Delegates at the time, I remember it vividly, we had dozens of insurers who were licensed by our insurance commissioner to write medical malpractice insurance coverage, and there were only two that were left standing at the time. We were in crisis in West Virginia, and I believe that if the gentleman's amendment is adopted, we're going to head back in that direction to the place where we were then.
Both Democratic and Republican senators stood to oppose the amendment as well, including Ron Stallings, a doctor, and Ed Gonch, an insurance salesman. Walters continued to fight for the amendment, though, saying if an administration knowingly chooses a bad employee or has too few employees working a given shift to save dollars, they should be held accountable at a higher level.
We're finding maggots living in bed sores of our senior citizens because of understaffing problems right now. And what we're doing is we're saying that we are going to look at that understaffing and say, that's fine, you're protected by the cap, instead of saying, no, that is willful, wanton, reckless disregard for those seniors, and we need to make sure the staffing is there. This just states that whenever the staffing is gross negligence, when they are grossly negligent on their hiring practices, then the protections will not apply. But if people call off, that's not gross negligence. If they did and they have papers on their files saying, hey, we did look, we did check in, and he ended up being bad, that's not gross negligence. Those would be protected under the caps. Those are accidents. This is saying that if you are grossly negligent, then the caps will not apply. If you have willful, wanton, reckless disregard for the protection of those patients, if you look at your bottom line and say, no, we're not going to staff this, make sure that they're getting turned over to prevent bed sores, that's reckless disregard.
After a roll call vote on the amendment, it failed 40-29 with one senator absent. Senator Mike Romano stood to amend the bill as well. His amendment also dealt with administrative immunities, but was more narrowly focused.
My concern lies in the hiring of a medical provider, a medical employee. Doesn't have to be a doctor, could be a nurse, could be a ward, anybody that works at a medical facility who has a known track record of criminal conduct, has a known track record of being a predator, being a pedophile. That would relieve the facility that hires them, whether it's an emergency service, a nursing home, a doctor's office, from any responsibility for that hiring because they're going to be covered by the caps.
Romano's amendment would remove a section of the definition of treatment so that hiring practices would not be covered by the caps. That amendment also failed on a voice vote.
Those opposed will say no. The noes have it. I declare the amendment rejected.
Senate Bill 6 will be up for a final vote in the Senate Monday. Now here's a look at some of the bills introduced in the House today.
–
Among the bills introduced in the House today, House Bill 2516, to provide for the awarding of a posthumous high school diploma to parents of a high school senior who dies during the senior year. House Bill 2520, to prevent an individual from being disqualified from receiving unemployment compensation benefits when their separation from employment is due to domestic violence, sexual offenses, or stalking by family or household members. On second reading, the amendment stage in the House on Monday, House Bill 2200, to revise, rearrange, consolidate, and recodify the laws of the state of West Virginia relating to child welfare and juvenile disposition. This bill was recommended for passage by the West Virginia Judiciary's Court Improvement Board. It's the product of a bipartisan effort of all the stakeholders to streamline the child welfare laws in the state.
This has been the Legislature Today. We'll be back next week with all of the news and information from the first regular session of the 82nd Legislature. We welcome your comments. You can send them to feedback@wvpublic.org or write us in care of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, 600 Capitol Street, Charleston, 25301. I'm Ashton Mara. Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Support for the Legislature Today is provided by the following.
The High Technology Foundation, headquartered at the I-79 Technology Park in Fairmont. Online at wvhtf.org.